ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, it's Waleed Ali here with the best of the Minefield from 2025 with my co-host Scott Stevens. Hello, Scott. How are you
doing? Hey, I'm good, Waleed.
It's one of my favourites, this.
This was a fun show. I wasn't convinced. It took a little bit of, well, let's just say that extortion may or may not have been involved because it is a genre that I don't particularly like, but this was a great one. There's no way it couldn't make the list. I was very happy to have been strong-armed into this particular episode.
I have finally gotten Scott, almost in spite of myself, to talk about stand-up comedy, a piece of stand-up comedy. Now, for background, Scott does not speak stand-up comedy. This is a completely foreign language to him. He doesn't seem to understand what it is or why it exists or why people like it. I've never seen him so much as, I don't know, exercise his muscles to the extent of a smirk in response to stand-up comedy. And yet, here we are. Scott, welcome.
There are a few things that aren't quite true in what you just said. Most of it's true. Almost all of it's true. There are just a couple of things that aren't.
Okay.
I will confess, you say I don't speak stand-up. That's actually probably exactly right. There's some languages, I'm pretty good with languages. There's some languages that I just cannot get them. But after watching this particular piece, believe it or not, the thing that came immediately to mind is this snarky little comment in one of Wittgenstein's notebooks. Yes, of course. Where he says, I understand how some people view Shakespeare as an undisputed, untranscendable master, but I don't like him. I love it. That makes me smile. I just think that is glorious.
That's your stand-up. Okay.
I can understand how people can watch stand-up, and the particular stand-up we're talking about today, I can understand how people can watch a routine and find it really, really funny. And I can appreciate even the art form, the quality of writing, the virtuosity, the timing, the physical gestures. I can understand and appreciate all of those things. I just don't find it funny. So the particular thing we're talking about today, hand to heart, did not smirk once, but... But I could appreciate the brilliance of it.
Oh, could you?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So the background to this is, I think we're breaking some Minefield rules by doing this, and time will tell whether or not that's a good idea. But when we do these book club things, they're usually works of art, and we come to them from a position of we accept that they're great in some way and that they have something to tell us that's broader than just the artwork itself and perhaps even the art form. Mm. They shed light on the moral life, perhaps. We can put it that way.
The other criteria is that these are things that reward multiple viewings. When you see it, watch it, consume it, indulge in it again, you discover things you didn't see before. And that's why there has to be something enduring about them, to some extent enduring.
Okay. Now, I don't know if today's subject meets all those criteria. Mm. It certainly doesn't meet the criteria of something of which you are a fan and have come to celebrate, what do you call it, a common object of love.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, now, it began because this is a bit of stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Goes for, what would we say, 6-7 minutes?
Yep.
Something like that. And I've watched quite a bit of stand-up comedy. I've worked with a lot of comedians. I like stand-up. I'm not someone who drowns in it, but I do like it. By and large, I find it disposable. I enjoy it. I move on. And that's not a slight. I think there's something about stand-up comedy that is designed for that.
That's right.
I had a very interesting conversation with actually a couple of comedians now where they've made that point to me is the way you do not assess stand-up comedy is its timelessness.
Mm.
because actually the whole point of the art form is the distillation of a moment in time. And maybe if something is screamingly funny in a moment and then not funny in another moment, that only shows just how well you've distilled.
And in fact, can I just push that one step further? It's not just that comedy needs to capture and needs to be in conversation with a particular moment in time, and that moment is then fleeting. It's not quite disposable, but it's simply ephemeral. There's a particular frisson, there's a particular engagement at that particular moment. But I think the other thing is that it is a particular engagement between the comedian and the people who are gathered. So just imagine the funniest comedian in the world talking on an empty television set to camera, and there's no accompanying laughter.
Yeah.
I would be shocked if that could be found in any way funny. In other words, along those two axes, the temporal axis of a particular moment in time, and call it the relational axis, the horizontal axis even, this particular engagement with this group of people that you're hearing responding to in real time, this particular comedian. It's real comedy. The best stand-up takes place at precisely those two intersections.
Yeah, which is why even the concept of a stand-up special on television or whatever is a bit of a weird one, actually. I mean, that's true. The necessity of its existence, but in a way, it's doing violence to the art form. It's the same reason that this thing that was quite popular, you know, at the height of cancel culture, where you would take a clip from a stand-up routine or a piece of audience interaction that went particularly badly or that would outrage people online. One of the frustrations comedians would constantly express to me is it's a different animal when you do that because you're removing it from the social and the quasi-contractual arrangements that exist within the room and the relational aspect of being in the room. Now, that's not to say that people in the room may not have been upset or whatever, but like it's just a different thing. And so you're assessing a thing not on its own terms, but on completely alien terms to it. So all of that said, let's just put that as background. What happened here is this particular bit of stand-up comedy. So it's a bit from John Mulaney's special, Kid Gorgeous at Radio City, which is a Netflix special. Came out in 2018, but was performed in 2017, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
It goes for an hour, just over. But the particular bit is what I would call the horse loose in a hospital bit. It's a bit whereby he describes the first Trump administration or the early days of it in a particular way and is just a riff on that. I think that might be one of the best pieces of stand-up comedy I've ever watched. It is rare in stand-up in that it is something I can watch over and over and over again and enjoy it every time. You can appreciate it as performance. You can appreciate it as writing. In that way, it sort of bears a resemblance, I think, to poetry. You know, there's this sort of weird argument about is poetry text or performance? This does straddle those things because it's clearly a piece of writing, and a masterful piece of writing, I would argue. And I somehow managed to convince you to agree to do it before you'd even watched it. I implored you to watch it first, but you were all in, and here we are. Given that, and given the act of charity that you've extended me in doing this, Scott, I want you to take this wherever you want. Scottify this as much as you possibly can. Oh, okay. Let's go Mindfield Bingo on this if you want.
All right. So I will just say my first instinct is to talk about the context in which this particular bit, the horse in the hospital routine, comes. But let me resist that just draw attention to two things first. There is something about the simile of a horse in a hospital that is immediately evocative and instantly self-explanatory. And I do suspect, and I even wonder how many people would have recognized that even beneath the instinctive grasp, yes, that would be a bizarre thing to see, to have happen. There's also an aesthetic dimension to it. The now notorious golden coif that sits atop Donald Trump's head, that being somehow aesthetically associated with a horse's mane. You can instantly, I mean, what color, can I ask you, if you close your eyes and think about this particular horse in the hospital, what color is the horse? It's golden, right?
Such a good point. It absolutely is, yep.
So you'd get the point about the horse, but you wouldn't get the additional aesthetic dimension as well. There's something almost instinctive about it. Yes, of course, it's a golden horse, which makes its ostentatiousness within the delicate or effete confines of a hospital even more devastating and hilarious. The other thing I think that's really interesting for me is the timing leading up to it.
So, you mean in time or you mean in the routine, in the special?
Within the special itself. So it's important, obviously, that the special occurs within the first 12 months of the first Trump presidency.
Yeah.
And there is an explicit signal that this isn't going to last very long. This is something that just kind of happened, and we're going to simply have to endure it. I mean, John Mulaney himself says, it's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. I think eventually everything's going to be okay, but I have no idea what's going to happen next. Neither do you, neither do your parents. And I think that reference to parents there is actually kind of important. So there's the idea that this is just a freak occurrence. It's going to be ridiculous in the interim, but it's going to come to an end before we know it, once all these people wake up and recognize that this is a ludicrous thing to have happen in the first place.
Well, that's interesting. I don't read it that way.
Yeah?
For two reasons. One, he uses the word eventually. And two, I don't think it's about people waking up necessarily, although I can kind of see how you could extract it from the routine. I read that as more him saying there's something aberrant about this whole situation. It's so unprecedented. It's hard to imagine how it could come into existence again because of the singularity of the horse. And perhaps even the setting of the hospital, but the horse, this is such an unlikely scenario that it's not about people coming to their senses so much as just the unlikeliness of this event in the first place. Now, of course, that looks very different from this vantage point where we've come back to a Trump administration. Although I would say one of the things that is most brilliant about this particular routine, but also most important for us to note, is it's very much a Trump 1 routine.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
It is not remotely a Trump 2
routine. Exactly.
The second Trump administration is quite different in character because of the far more direct consequential elements of it. You know, the wars that are happening, the trade wars and military wars.
This is no longer just spectacle.
No, that's a much better way of putting it. Whereas early, the first Trump administration, one of the things that kind of characterized it was in its way ineffectual. Actually, when you stop and you go, well, what did he do? What damage was done? It's hard to articulate. Not hard at all to articulate in the case of the second Trump administration, if you want to make that case. But I don't get the sense it's everyone coming to their senses so much as just perhaps the natural progression of things.
Yeah, I just disagree. I think the presumption there is this is something that people let loose. What were you thinking? How did you think, at one particular point, how did you think that a horse was going to improve hospital efficiency?
Yeah.
And then people will realize. So that's the political context. And I think you're absolutely right. The fact that it's Trump 1 is important. But then there's the timing of the lead up itself. So the entire special is kind of frenetic. It's not Robin Williams frenetic.
No.
It's not Jim Carrey zany. But it is relentless and deliberate. It is a piece of writing. And you get the sense that the entire thing that's being woven for you is fictitious, and it's deliberately so. So you're being led artificially, strategically, from one thing to the next, and then when you do little loops back to, for instance, a ghost in an overly long t-shirt, then you can make the connections to what happened, you know, 20 minutes or so before. And then there's the pause. There's the pause after building a gazebo in the middle of the Civil War. That's kind of like doing stand-up now. And there's the laugh, there's the applause, and then there's the pause. And to my mind, one of the great physical comedic moments of the entire hour is him uncomfortably swinging the microphone cord back and forth and back and forth, almost like a little child who's delaying, who's buying for time. And then there's the introduction of the political moment. And I think what's so interesting there is not only is the political moment not exactly welcomed on his part, you get the sense that a political moment is emerging in the middle of a deliberately depoliticized form of entertainment.
From someone with a depoliticized aesthetic.
The depoliticized aesthetic, I think, is absolutely vital. So again, for those who maybe haven't watched it, John Mulaney does himself up like a kind of cross between, I don't know, Buddy Holly and Cary Grant and Edward R. Murrow and a little bit of Jimmy Stewart. He has kind of that Jimmy Stewart, oh, shucks, man. You know, he kind of has that deliberately inoffensive, deliberately 1950s throwback about him, and the fact that he's in a plain black and white suit. And then you've got the slicked back hair. And it's also worth noting, I think, that the interesting word that he uses to kick off the horse in a hospital routine is, things are a little bit sticky, which again is a kind of Leave It to Beaver 1950s, deliberately sweet, non-political way of describing a really, really contentious situation. And then the fact that he launches into a bit of political commentary, which isn't political commentary at all, but a kind of these things don't go together. What then makes it kind of genius is that you have the delay beforehand, the swinging of the microphone cord, the standing on the precipice with the crowd. Is he really going to say something political? And then when he does, there is no mention whatsoever of the name Trump. And yet there's something about the physicality of the animal, doubtless golden. There's then the way that he kind of ventriloquizes at a couple of points Trump's own voice.
Without overdoing
it. Without overdoing it. The whole thing is understated. I think the interesting thing about that is, can you imagine a stand-up like this taking place on, say, the Ed Sullivan Show? You basically can. You can imagine this on a 1950s CBS sound set. Yes, you can. With all of the deliberately understated political elements. And what he then trades for political explicitness is the one moment in the entire routine where he engages in what I can only refer to as 1950s zaniness. The horse in the hospital is a zany analogy of the order of I Love Lucy. It's a zany analogy that's appropriate, say, for something like The Three Stooges. And yet it contrasts the rest of the relatively polite, middle-class, Midwest nice aesthetic on the soundstage of Radio City, New York, no less. And I think that all those things then come together to make this a moment of, even though we're after the Trump one period, as a sketch, I think the virtuosity is quite extraordinary.
So can I unpack a little bit of that virtuosity? One of the things I love about this bit, and that I think is the reason I can watch it over and over and over again, is its precision. But also its generality. It's simultaneously precise and unspecific. Right from the very start, even, the way he begins, we've sort of identified several beginnings, haven't we, to this, but the one that I want to identify is when he says, this is how I look at things and this is just me, right? So he's immediately positioning himself as, I don't know anything about politics. I'm just a general guy. I don't have any really strong political commitments. This is just the way I've come to try to understand what's going on.
He deliberately foregrounds his ignorance and his inexpertness.
Yes, and that runs all the way through, right through to I wasn't paying attention. I don't pay attention. I don't check up on people, all this sort of stuff. You might think it's an ignorant answer, but it's not. It's a great answer. All these little bits throughout it, his ignorance is part of the whole thing. And in that way, I think he mirrors a kind of what you might want to, I don't know, imagine as a middle America, right? These are not people who are hardcore Democrats or Republicans or committed to 100 days of resistance, as I think Alec Baldwin launched around this time. It's not that. But the starting point I want to identify is where he says, this guy being the president. It's a brilliant sentence. He's not saying the president, because that implies someone who is of the office.
Mm-hmm.
He's this guy, he's being the president. He's like, he's role playing in this thing. And it immediately sets up the horse losing hospital.
So hang on.
He's not where they expected to be.
Yeah, but also, Willie, this guy being the president, it's turning the presidency into a verb, not an office. That's important.
Yeah, I think that's right. So there's all that, but it's brilliant because, remember the social context, every comedian is getting up on stage and just lacerating Donald Trump and lacerating anyone who would have voted for him or could possibly like him, safe in the knowledge that none of those people are in the audience. What Mulaney does here, by not ever mentioning Trump, by never really, apart from one exception, which I'll come to, referring to anything specific that Trump really did, he leaves everything at the level of generality where you in the audience are doing all the work. He's identified a certain truth about this, right to the adoption of the analogy or the metaphor of the horse loose in a hospital. It's not a bear, it's a horse. So I'm not immediately coding it as something that's dangerous or something that we should hate, as an object of hate.
It's not bad. It's just inappropriate.
It's just wrong. It's just in the wrong place. It doesn't even really know what to do there or even how it got there, right? It's not a bull in a china shop. Again, too immediately destructive and too hackneyed as a kind of metaphor that you would use. The line where he sets it up, where he says, when there's a horse loose in a hospital, you have to stay updated. And he gestures, you know, scrolling through his phone. And he said, what did the horse do? The updates, they're not always bad. Sometimes they're just odd. The horse used the elevator today. I didn't know he knew how to do that. Okay, that could refer to absolutely anything, but everyone immediately knows that feeling. They remember that feeling. There's something I think about the mastery of being able to identify or happen upon the best way of illustrating or capturing or evoking a feeling, a sense of things without ever really getting into a specific policy that you may or may not have liked or a specific moment. There are perhaps two exceptions. One, where he fires the horse catcher. And I think I read this as a reference to, you know, the various institutions that are meant to keep Trump held accountable, FBI investigations, whatever. And you can fill that in a little bit. But even that has a kind of gentleness. And then there's the other one where it's a clear reference to Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm. Where hippo, he talks about the hippo. Away, yeah.
And that, I think this instructively, is the weakest part of the bit. And I found it the weakest part of the bit because that's the moment when the specificity arrives, where he seems to be commenting on something that is too direct that the artfulness of the analogy, the ability for the audience to play with it, the way he can identify or articulate something that is undeniably true without ever actually saying anything that you can identify specifically, that's where that breaks. And I think it's a good bit, but I think it's the weakest part that. And if that were not there, I would actually think the bit would be improved. Now, that said, he knows a lot more about this than I do. He's not taking notes from me.
But. Yeah, the zaniness becomes political satire.
A little bit, yeah.
And then it loses its punch. I think that's right.
Yeah. And then the last observation I want to make about all that is, in approaching it that way, he does something I think, could be wrong, and there might be another way of reading it, but he does something I think that is actually almost virtuous, which is he manages to engage in a civic conversation without hectoring, without yelling, without putting himself as a position of the knower of things over the audience, specifically positioning himself as the ignorant one, along with all of us. You know, we're kind of all in this boat. And in so doing, I think he invites people who might even have been a touch sympathetic to the horse to laugh along. I think it's pretty clear he doesn't think the horse should have been let into the hospital. So he has a position, but it's a position that has a kind of gentle, I'm going to say non-judgmentalism about it. In fact, he says, I don't judge anyone, but sometimes I ask people. I think he has his judgments. I guess what I'm saying is it's a piece of comedy and a piece of commentary that has entry points for various people. And he simultaneously is poking fun at the people at brunch who think the horse shouldn't be in the hospital. In other words, the butt of the joke becomes the absurdity of the whole situation, something that is shared not just by people who are committed in a political way. And in an era of heightened political commentary in comedy, an era that, you know, we've discussed on this show, and which I kind of ended up lamenting, and I've confessed having said I would like to see more political comedy, having seen it, thought actually this is a very bad idea,
yeah,
because now political commentary is being led by comedians rather than people who might actually have better political analysis to offer. This just felt refreshing to me. And maybe that's why I feel like I can watch it over and over and over again, because there are points in there. There's the occasional barb, but there's a care there. There's something about it that seems to maintain, or perhaps he's trying even to maintain, something of the civil fabric. Even the point where he seems to say good things about Obama. You know, I thought the last guy was good at his job. You hear the audience erupt into applause. I can see in him, maybe I'm misinterpreting this, but I can see in him a desire to move on. No, 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 that's not the bit to applaud.
You got that exactly right. Because he says, then again, I'm not the sort of person that pays a lot of attention to those things when someone seems to be, has the appearance of doing their job well.
Right. And so he's not saying, wasn't Obama great? Isn't this guy terrible? I think the audience, some of the audience at least, is hearing that. But they applaud. He said, I thought the last guy was good at his job. They applaud. And he immediately repeats the line as if to try to take back the talking stick in the room. I think that shows a certain, at least a desire for this not to descend into, you know, trench warfare, political bomb throwing, anything like that, but to remain in a playful mode that's inviting to people, even as he has points that he wants to make. And for that reason, in that particular social context, I just found it masterful.
Okay. I'm so glad you brought up the people at brunch wondering what the horse has done. That wasn't, for me, the killer line. The killer line was, I don't remember that on Hamilton.
Yes.
Now, okay, my loathing of Hamilton should be familiar to anybody who listens to this show. Mm-hmm. But the sheer degree of self-righteousness surrounding people who loved Hamilton and believed that Hamilton itself was a kind of education in the true meaning of American patriotism, I just found the entire thing surrounding Hamilton kind of repulsive. And so his constant attempt to pivot away from anything that could be partisanly aligned, but also anything that had that whiff of kind of, let's call it, upper class or educated disdain. Now, this gets to the really interesting point, because what I think John Mulaney is advocating here, if you are decent, if you are a decent person, you know that horses don't belong in hospitals. This offends the canons of decency, not moral rectitude, not righteousness, but just decency. And so the fact that he presents himself as a kind of 1950s middle class, middle America, decent throwback, the references that he makes throughout to middle class morality in the form of decency and politeness, even what he refers to at one point as meaningless politeness rules. What he's essentially doing is, instead of engaging in what you just called kind of partisan trench warfare, he's saying that decent people can agree that this is inappropriate. Here's my slight problem. And then that goes along with the whole aesthetic. Yep. There is a fair degree of nostalgia that saturates the show. And that nostalgia for different epochs, for different eras, even the way that he kind of frames himself as an old person in a relatively young person's body, you know, he comes across as a grump or a crank, but he doesn't look that way. He just looks like Jimmy Stewart. Mm. My one concern is that throughout the performance, he is sending up the arbitrary nature of old-fashioned values, of old-style taking it slow, having to fill your day with all sorts of meaningless stuff just to make the hours go by. He's sending that all up as kind of ill-suited to the times, as get off my lawn type middle-class longing for a simpler, slower time. If he's then using a degree of political decency as his crutch, as the hook, it's almost as if you can feel the heart, the thread that runs through the routine, beginning to unravel at precisely this bit. It loses a degree of coherence that I think doesn't quite stand up to the kind of analysis that this good a piece of writing should invite.
I think I just don't quite read the overall special that way, but you might be right. All right, you're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Well, Lee Daly is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. We have a guest. Scott, should I do the honours?
Yes, please do it.
All right. With these sorts of shows, we often like to get a practitioner, particularly if Scott and I are the furthest people you could imagine from being a practitioner of the particular art form. We've done that this time. We have scoured the landscape of stand-up comedians and found the most unemployed of them. Sam Taunton is his name. He is my colleague not so very long ago on a show called The Project, a comedian of wonderful skill and also someone who knows so much about the craft of stand-up comedy. And I say that because part of the history to this whole show is that Sam and I have discussed this particular bit in our dressing room as we're getting ready to go on television so many times that it felt just frankly wrong to choose anybody else to come in and speak. So Sam, good to see you again.
Hello guys. Thank you for having me to discuss. I agree, the one true art, which is stand-up comedy. Everything else doesn't matter. That's so true about this bit. We've discussed it more than any other stand-up bit that I've ever spoken about with anyone, even in comedy circles. We've even tried to do, like, try to match the analogy for certain situations, trying to come up with our own descriptions. And it's so hard to do. And I think that's kind of what leads to it being, I hate to use the word timeless, because, I mean, to agree with your point, I feel like comedy shouldn't be timeless a lot of the time, but it really holds on and it stays with you because I think the analogy is truly so strong. I think the thing about observations in comedy, I always think, is that, you know, anyone can make an observation about anything and you can be like, that's bang on, that's great. But the good ones, they sit just below the surface. And when they hit you, you have a feeling that's kind of simultaneously, that's it. I thought that, but at the same time, I didn't think that.
And I never would have thought.
And I never would have thought that. But now I've seen that, I can never look at that context in any other light. Mm. And I think this is maybe the most perfect example of that. I'm fascinated to know the writing process behind John coming up with it. My gut tells me the way that a lot of stand-up comedians work, he might have been at brunch one day and they were talking about Trump and he just riffed it and then he went, oh, that's it, you know, and the bit probably evolved from there. That is my gut feeling about how it happened. But from start to finish, it's a masterful piece of writing. And I think, you know, analyzing stand-up comedy like this is... Well, firstly, it's one of the most unfunny things you could ever do. Yeah.
But welcome also to the minefield.
But I think it's interesting because so many of these things that you guys just highlighted then, and I was riveted from start to finish, I think he's done subconsciously. Like to think he sat down, and he is a word-perfect writer, that's the thing, but so many of these things would have just oozed out of him in a Mulaney way, I think, because the nostalgia points got you brought up, I think, is so important because not only this special or this bit, but everything about him, the whole persona is that 1950s Ed Sullivan, great reference point as well. That's kind of who he is. He's a man caught in a different time. He focuses on nostalgia. He focuses on childhood things. And even when he does all these childhood act outs that he does in a lot of his stand-up, when you kind of go to the place when he's doing the act outs, you're not imagining a guy who's in his early 40s now. So we're talking about early 90s. I'm imagining a guy in the 30s, like in America. It's so interesting how he's managed to do it. And I think the reason this bit kind of cuts through so much is because you're almost going back in time when politics was a bit more civil in the way he's discussing it. And I think that's
where it was possible to sit in a room with people who voted the other way.
Exactly. Yeah. And I feel like regardless of where you sat on the political spectrum at the time, it might be different now. Obviously, this is not Trump 2.0, but I feel like it really brings people in regardless of where you sat. You could agree with it regardless of your feelings towards the subject matter.
Here's the danger, Sam. Mm. I love everything you just said.
Yes.
Here's the danger. The show is dripping with nostalgia. Mm. Can I just say, that aesthetic, I loved it. I'm a sucker for nostalgia. No.
You got to watch more stand-up comedies, because there's a lot of it there.
So let's just think about a couple things, though. I mean, there are references to phones, to mobile phones, and the way that phones used to be. There are references to fast cars and really, really, really slow cars. There are references to people standing at dockside waving at ships because they had nothing else to do but wave to a ship containing people that they didn't know just because the ship was there and they had nothing else on. So there are all of these contrasts, the speed with which we live now, the slowness then, the busyness of our lives now, the relative emptiness then. He sets up the whole thing. I was standing in a gazebo. It doesn't matter why. I was standing in a gazebo in Connecticut, of all places. In other words, he's kind of saying that what stand-up is, what this routine is, what the nostalgia of what he's doing is kind of like a gazebo. It's a little bit useless. It's a momentary social gathering place. It probably doesn't mean anything. It's probably ineffectual. It's probably just a convention. And it somehow doesn't quite fit anymore. And I don't have to remind the two of you that he's doing this at the very moment when all sorts of people are saying the usual rules of political civility don't count anymore. When you're faced with fascists, when you're faced with an anti-democratic crisis, when you're faced with racists and Nazis and white supremacists, it doesn't do just to be decent, just to be civil. It's almost as if, in other words, he's kind of staking a really tenuous, flimsy political claim at the very moment when everything else, and he acknowledges this, everything else is kind of burning all around him. That feels really, really tenuous to me, as does the reference to a horse, which can't help but, you would expect, be followed by something like a cart. In other words, the entire thing is, it's not right for the moment. And I just wonder, is this one of those things, does this make the stand-up routine endure? Or does it risk consigning it to, oh, wasn't it nice when we thought that Trump was just a flash in a pan?
Well, yeah, look, the whole thing is a time capsule. The point about none of it fits and the comment of like the gazebo is such a brilliant bit.
It is. Yeah.
I mean, I know it's like a small paragraph when you see it all written down, but the way it holds is amazing. And as a precursor to this thing, you're totally right, I think, about how it sets up that he's kind of out of place in the same way the gazebo is. But it's such a comment which leads to this, because I think in the time period, and I probably consume a lot more stand-up comedy than you guys. I can't stress how many people were talking about Trump. Comedians were, and to your point earlier, Waleed, that like people were looking to comedians for political discourse and be political commentators. And the gazebo bit, then into the line where he says it's, you know, building a gazebo in the Civil War. It's like stand-up comedy now. It's so perfect for the moment. And then to lead into this kind of loose analogy without saying things, but really saying things. It's such a comment on comedy as much as it is on, I think, like political discourse or even political ideology or where that particular country was heading. And I guess the nostalgia thing really drenches it in that fact as well. It's kind of like, it's not the bro-y comic being like, what's Trump doing now? Or the kind of smarmy, you know, being like, really? Did you think you'd get away with that, Donald, type thing? Like, it's... Yeah, I mean, apologies.
He knows all the bits. Yeah,
I am in the ABC right now, I realise. It's so interesting. And I think, like, look, if I can take it back one more step to just look at the pure structure of the joke, the end point is also very fascinating to me. Where he chooses to end the bit, talking about his wife being Jewish and being Nazis, it's such a detour.
But Trump unleashing these new Nazis.
Exactly. Who,
one of the most brilliant lines, I don't care for these new Nazis, and you may quote me on that.
You
it's sort of like, look how brave I am
to
take this position, but then leads to the comment about his wife being Jewish.
Totally, but also you can quote me on that. It's a great link back to the line where you feel like people are trying to clap at the Obama thing, and he really puts them back in their place and kind of moves on. Because at the time, there was a craving. This is like the Nanette time period, right?
Yeah.
And there was a craving for comedy to kind of be more as well. People wanted to feel things in comedy. And I feel like he was very much against that. He pushed through. People wanted to clap and be like, yeah, we're doing the right thing. Because I feel like wearing your ideology on your sleeve really was becoming more prominent in a late kind of, what was it,
2017.
2017, yeah. It kind of felt like that. So he's bookended it with this bit about Nazis. It's come through with gazebos. And I think if you look at the whole special, you could be like, thematically, he was doing these bits just to get into the other bits. And there's a lot of truth in that. When you put together stand-up, you're trying to find a way to structure it so it doesn't feel like you're doing bit to another bit.
Yeah, but let me just say, though, the fact that he goes from Nazis, I mean, there are all these kind of subtle little political things. So because there's a horse in a hospital, I get to say the N-word on television. Those things just don't go together.
I know.
So there's that, which is actually quite clever. And now they're Nazis. And there's a wonderful kind of callback then to his reference to his father trying to...
Oh, it's shame.
Trying to destroy a little 10-year-old's argument about not standing up to a bully at school by bringing in sort of the ludicrousness of Nazis now. But then the fact that he translates the reference to Nazis to something that really could have been straight out of Honeymooners. or could have been straight out of I Love Lucy. In other words, turning something that really would be politically quite seismic and existential and turn it into a way of insulting your Jewish wife. There's something about that that, again, it's quaint. It's incredibly nostalgic.
Mm, it's so nostalgic. I think the moments he breaks out of the analogy are very powerful. And I think it is all planned. Like, for example, I mean, the best joke is probably, to me, it's centered around the I have fired the horse catcher line, because that is a clear, no one's disputing what he's talking about. And the same with the N-word on TV. It's like those little snippets. It's like we're all playing along. We're having a fun riff about this, like, hypothetical horse in the hospital. We know what it's talking about, but it is so fun. And then the realness hits you hard. It's such a great comedic technique to break you out of it and then pull you back in. And the reason I think I fired the horse catcher is such a great line, because it is drenched in, there's a moment where you go, oh, that is actually pretty bad when you think about it. You know, so you have all of these emotions running through, but it comes off a bit that you think's the weakest part, Waleed. The
hippo in the swamp.
Yeah, and I agree, as a pure writing part of it, that's weak. I mean, I feel like anyone could have been like, oh yeah, then there's a hippo with a nuclear bomb, because that's, you know, like what's going on at the time. But I think he does that purely to make it more accessible, and he's getting to this horse catcher line, which he knows is going to really get a big laugh. Because at the core for all of this, and I think when analyzing comedy, you have to remember that laughter is actually the most important thing. To your point, Scott, that if there's no audience, and if you know you saw someone doing it without anyone there, would you laugh? The answer is no, and I can tell you from experience. I've done, as a quick side note, I did a corporate gig once and no one was there, and the guy still made me go on. And he said, just get up and get started. And I said, but there's no one here. And he said, yeah, people might turn up. And so I did 20 minutes to no one, which was not a lot of laughter, let me tell you. But the point is that you need the laughter to flow onto these things. And writing is often dictated by the laughter. And I think he had the horse catcher line and he knew it was such a diversion. We're going to break it. But after he'd done the N-word on TV line, the next chunk he goes into the hippo thing, I think he had to lead. It's not a classic misdirect in a comedic sense, but it takes you to another place. Mm. So you're going somewhere and it is a bit weaker, almost on purpose, to build it up. And he has that line, he's like that poor Andy Cohen in those reunion things. I don't understand that reference, but I assume it's...
People who do think it's very funny.
Totally, yeah. Right? But it's just such a diversion. Now you're in pop culture. And then he's like, maybe the horse catcher will catch the horse. I've fired the horse catcher. It's like detonating a bomb.
Yeah, it does have that effect.
And so I feel like that bit structurally is so important to get there. And
yeah, you might be right about that, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny that you love the, I don't remember that in Hamilton. To me, that is the weakest tag in the whole piece.
No, I'm with Scott on
it's
that, totally.
It's such a, it's an add-on, and I get it, because often when you're performing comedy, the writing comes from doing it often, so you'll have bases of the things you like, and you'll have written things, but then it'll expand as you're doing it. And to me, he just
I'll tell you why it's brilliant.
It gets a laugh because people are like, yeah, Hamilton. I get it. But
it's because what is being sent up there is this idea that people feel like they have a kind of unimpeachable political view of things without recognizing that actually all they are is part of a social group that thinks all the same things, takes in all the same stuff, is educated in all the same quite superficial ways about these things. I don't remember that in Hamilton. How could it possibly be true if it wasn't in Hamilton? I think the choice of that, that's the lacerating bit. So I didn't see it as an add-on. I saw it as the bit that brought that whole...
Really? I just disagree.
It's the I got my civics education from Hamilton.
Yes.
I know everything that's important about the American experiment, the American experience, because of Hamilton.
Yeah.
And look, diversity, isn't it great?
I know.
It was the self-righteousness surrounding Hamilton. Right?
I know. I just think maybe because now Hamilton, to me, at least in comedy circles, is a bit of a punchline. Yeah. Mm. Mulaney, he might have been at the forefront of dissect. Like now I would feel like it would be a bit hacked to be like doing something about Hamilton.
Fair.
So
that's
maybe
fair.
That's a great example of comedy.
The time boundness of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see it bringing it together, but I still remember seeing that for the first time being like, come on, John.
Oh, no, I thought it was... Anyway, just one final thing on the horse catcher line.
Yes.
He says, I've fired the horse catcher, and then he says, he doesn't seem like he should be able to... He can do that?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like something you should be able to do, no matter who the horse
That's
is.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a very clever line, because it takes you back into that position of... this isn't about the personality of, I'm not worried about this because I don't like Donald Trump. That just doesn't seem like something that anyone should be able to do.
Yeah.
So it's just part of, I think, the overall expertness of the way he's constructed it so as not to be personal, partisan, or committed in that sort of way. Can I just ask you a broader question about art and how this relates to it?
Wow.
One of the things that's really common, yeah, this is not as big as I've just set it up to be. One of the things that's really common in stand-up is you find a metaphor, an analogy for something.
Yeah.
That's the punchline.
Yeah.
And then you move on to the next bit. The gazebo bit that we've referenced a few times, very short.
Yeah.
Right? You say, hey, have you seen X? That's like Y. And everyone thinks, that's funny. What strikes me here as being really interesting is it's 7 minutes on an analogy.
Yeah.
Which is rare. I don't know that I've seen that. I don't know. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head where comedians do that.
Yeah, 7 minutes is a long time.
Because
it can get old very,
very quickly. But on the other hand, I'm reminded of something that a classical composer once told me of all things, where he said, actually, if you think about classical music, the best pieces of classical music are not the ones with the most ideas in them. All these complex ideas. They're the ones that have one idea or two ideas, and they are just so thoroughly explored through the sound. You know, they're refracted through different keys, through different instruments. They're think of Beethoven's Fifth, right? Just the opening bars of that. It's just the same theme, right?
Yeah.
Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. It's all, it's just one idea.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again, refracted through different sort of prisms. And that's what makes it immensely satisfying. And I had that in mind as I was watching this, going, the fact he has spun so much out of this one analogy without it ever being overwrought is what makes it ascend to a level that I would happily call art.
I mean, it's an interesting observation because I think you can take away a lot of that from Mulaney. To further that music analogy, I think it's why it's like a three-piece rock band, for example. Like some of the greats have all been three pieces because you get to play with space. You're not drowning in layers of having, you know, 12 musicians all getting in and building and building and building. Space and simplicity and, I guess, knowing when to push and when to pull back is often as beautiful and as important and as symbolic as other things. Mulaney's a master of word economy, I think, in comedy, where he knows when to get out. And if you watch a lot of his specials, particularly this one, he will do jokes when you're like, is that it? And then you're into the next bit. And it feels like you only just touched on the premise and he's like, I don't need any more and I'm out, which you don't see a lot, especially in this kind of conversational style of comedy that's been popularized. I think the analogy to go that long is something I haven't seen. He has a similar bit in his previous special to this one called The Comeback Kid, where he talks about the saying, why buy a cow when you can get the milk for free? It's a very, very funny joke. And it probably goes for 5 minutes and he takes it and plays the persona of being a cow, married to a cow. And it's very funny. But I think it's because for a few reasons, I think deep down, he did want to comment on Trump. He felt like he had to make a comment on the situation in his country at the time. Everyone kind of was doing it. How could he do it in a Mulaney way that suits his nostalgic conservative, maybe not politically conservative, but at least civilly and in a polite sense, being a conservative guy. And once he stumbled onto this, he wasn't going to let it go. And I think you can highlight a few things in the way he sets up the bit. It's a master of premise setting. And I think in comedy writing, and if you've ever unfortunately had the experience of doing stand-up comedy, one thing that takes a long time to learn is how important the premise to an idea is. And in other pieces of writing,
the punchline is not actually.
The punchline is often the specificity, which is maybe why the Hamilton line, again, I'm just he's thrown it on. But the idea is the most important bit. And you see in that first, maybe it's 30 seconds, he repeats the premise of the analogy. In fact, he does it back to back at one point after he says, this guy being president, it's like a horse loose in a hospital. And then again, immediately repeats it. He says, it's like a horse loose in a hospital so that no one, there cannot be anyone in that room who is not on board with what he's talking about.
The image is there.
The image is there and then repeats it and then goes a bit further and then repeats it again very slowly. He goes, because it's like a horse loose in a hospital. And to have, you can't do a bit that long without that existing. Because you could have a punchline where it's like, hey, there's a Trump guy. It's like a horse loose in the hospital. How about that? You know, you don't know what's going to happen. You get a laugh and you get out. But if you're going to anchor it around it, you have to have the premise so strong. For him to keep it going, it obviously goes in other directions. Probably my personal favorite joke, maybe it's not the best joke, but my favorite joke is when he starts talking about Obama, or the previous guy, as he calls him. And people are like, well, he was inefficient. And he's like, get out of here with these facts. And then he talks about, he goes, you're like the kid at the sleepover who says, when you say, oh, it's a good night, he goes, it's actually tomorrow. It's like, get out of here. And then he's like, get out of here with your EpiPen. To me, that's it's almost a Seinfeld-y observational piece of comedy that he's welded into the premise. And it kind of shows the different directions you can take it all in. But to go for 7 minutes on this thing, I guarantee he didn't plan on it going that long. But once he got onto a good thing, you kind of ride it as far as you can
go. But it's so easy not to know when to stop.
Yeah. And, you know, there's an argument that he did go too long. Like, I think.
That's interesting. I don't think that, but yeah.
Well, I wonder what it's like. I mean, and Scott, you brought up this point at the start, which I thought was terrific about, or it might have been you, Waleed.
Hey!
Comedy is not supposed to be viewed on a screen. And I stand by that, even as someone that, you know, is in this new world of clipping up stand-up clips to get them out there. Experiencing it in person, in a room full of people, completely changes the dynamic. Watching it in the room, I don't think it goes for that long, but I can see how if you consume it watching the special, you'd be like, Yeah, we get the point that the horse is in the hospital. So there is an argument it goes for too long. But the way he manages to create the rolling laughter, I find, to me, is the thing that I really admire. It's just a wave. Each line is delivered as a punchline, even if it's a setup line, or within a beautiful analogy. I've never seen something like that before. There's very few points that are not laugh points.
Yeah. It also, because there are so many dimensions to it, right? Even the bit, which we haven't spoken about at all, there are no experts.
Yeah.
They get these experts on the news, and then we cross now to someone who once saw a bird in an airport, right? All this sort of stuff.
I love that.
So that, all right, now he's having a crack at the media or the way that the media is trying to grasp it. Then he's off to brunch. Then he's talking to the person who let the horse in. Then it's the horse himself, or it's you, the way you stay updated, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I think what made it possible, I guess, is that the phenomenon of Trump, both times, but certainly first time, was just so all-encompassing. And so it dominated the psyche and so many aspects of life, what you consumed, what you were speaking about, all these sorts of things, that it just gave you all these sorts of places to go.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Waleed. I do think, though, that then kind of underscores the moral force, if you can talk about that, of this particular set, which is no matter who you are, no matter who you vote, no matter your political persuasions, surely we can all get around this point, that the hospital is too delicate a place to accommodate a horse. And that's why I do think it probably goes a little bit too long when he gets to the point of leaving one's baby with Gary Busey.
Oh, I love that.
No. There's the association of artificially blonde hair and Maine and Trump, but also Gary Busey is just a bit of a malevolent kind of, there's something there about vice that I think begins to unwind this really precarious act.
That's interesting.
Can I just also mention, Bob Dylan had me when he could fit, you've read all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books and the line, tax-deductible charity organizations within the line of a song. The fact that he includes in this overall thing references to Jane Austen, Leonard Bernstein, the unforgettable name of J.J. Bittenbinder. it is a superior piece of comedic writing, apart from anything else. And that's caused all of us to lean into a little bit, as we wouldn't do, I think, with any other stand-up routine.
Yeah, probably not.
Why is this word here? Why has this been placed where it has? I mean, I think Waleed's right, and the sheer amount of profanity that exists within that one little portion concerning the horse and the hippopotamus, that does feel a little bit more freewheeling, but the rest of it is so deliberate, I think, and so carefully constructed that you just, even if you don't laugh, you got to take your hat off to it.
Oh, wow. When Scott's hat comes off.
I mean, wow.
For stand-up comedy, that's a big moment.
Well, as I said, it's a superior art form. I agree.
You will not win Scott over on that point. But no. Hey, thanks so much for coming in, Sam.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott. If you ever want tickets to a comedy show, you know, I'll hook you up, mate.
First prize, one ticket. Second prize, two tickets.
Well done. Sam Taunton, Australian comedian, presenter on all sorts of media platforms, one-time colleague of mine, I guess, for this week's edition of The Mindfield, Not Quite a Book Club, which is now at an end. I'll see you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.